Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 258 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. And this is going to be series 42. And just as a reminder, especially for those of you taking your Step 2 CK exams this month or early next month, I have again the 10-hour class. Again, it's been well received by a ton of people. At this point, a pretty decent number of people have gone through the course, probably close to 300. So I have it this Saturday. There's still a very few spots remaining. It's a 10-hour class. And again, between 6 and 10 a.m. Pacific time, noon and 4 p.m. Pacific time, and 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific time, we would review about almost 800 vignettes that cut across medicine, surgery, OB-GYN, peds, psych, and neuro. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. Again, it's on the 5th of September. It's literally this Saturday via Zoom. And then next week, Thursday, from 4 to 6 or 6:30 p.m. Pacific, I'll be holding a test-taking strategies course. Basically, the main focus of the course will be how to work on NBME exams. And then on Friday and Saturday next week, this 10-hour course, I'm going to break it up into 2 days. I'm going to have like a 2-day version. So meet for 5 hours on Friday, the 11th of September, and for 5 hours on Saturday, the 12th of September. So if you're interested in any of these courses, again, I'll reach out to me, and then we'll kind of take things from there. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question, you know, about like a 3-year-old kid? Or they may even make this a 23-year-old female, or they can make this a 56-year-old male, right? They can basically make this any age. And you see this person over a couple of hours, not days, few hours. This person goes from well to hanging on for dear life, right? This person has like profound respiratory distress, is tripoding, has like crazy high fevers. These are not people that get fevers of 100.8. No. On NBME exams, these people's fevers are like 102. If you see this, what are you thinking about? I would really hope you're telling me that you're thinking about epiglottitis, right? Epiglottitis. And I mean, if it's someone that's unvaccinated, obviously it could be like H flu, although it could also conceivably be like strep pneumo, for example, right? So remember, there are many things these days that cause epiglottitis, and more commonly these days, it's probably not going to be H flu on a test, right? But remember, whenever a person has epiglottitis, your first step is to go ahead and perform an endotracheal intubation for those people, right? And remember, for these people, if you're giving them antibiotic therapy, you want to give them a third-generation cephalosporin, right? A third-generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, right? And then, don't forget that if you were to take like a lateral neck radiograph of these people, you'll see like the thumb sign, right? That's a classic thing you see on exams. And then, what if they give you a question about like a person that was just, you know, he just returned from deployment in like some country, and then this person for the last 3 weeks, this person has been having like cough, has been having hemoptysis, and they tell you that he has lost like 12 pounds of weight over that time period. I would really hope if you see something like this, you're thinking more along the lines of TB, right? You're thinking more along the lines of TB. And again, whenever you see a person that has TB like this, whenever they are symptomatic, you want to try to go for definitive diagnosis, right? Especially judging that this person is pretty high risk. So for these people, you want to, you know, kind of do this acid fast. You want to do like a bronchial alveolar lavage, or, you know, get like an induced sputum sample and do the acid fast bacilli stain on it, right? And then you obviously send off the sputum for culture, right? To try to figure out if this person has TB. And obviously, if a person has TB, right, you want to put them on the right regimen, right? You want to give them rifampin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol, right? Plus vitamin B6. And one thing I want to call to your attention here is it's actually high yield to know the toxicity is associated with those TB medications, right? So we know that isoniazid, right, can cause a peripheral neuropathy, right? And it can also, is also hepatotoxic, right? And remember that isoniazid can also cause a drug-induced lupus, right? Remember those antihistone antibodies. Please don't forget, right, isoniazid, remember, it can also cause an anemia. If you take it for a long enough period of time, you can get a sideroblastic anemia. Because if you remember from step one, right, if you remember the synthesis of heme, right, I'm sure some of you are like, oh, yeah, I do remember this from back in the day, right? So if you remember in the synthesis of heme, the first step, right, involves like glycine, right, and succinyl-CoA, right, coming together under the action of an enzyme, right? aminolevulinic acid synthesis, ALAS, right? Remember, ALAS uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor, right? So if you take isoniazid and don't listen to your doctor in taking a pyridoxal phosphate, then that reaction is not going to work. If it doesn't work, well, guess what? You're going to have a lot of problems, right? A lot of problems, right? So the person will have a sideroblastic anemia because they essentially have issues with heme synthesis. So if they give you a question about a person that has been on isoniazid for a couple of months and the person has a microcytic anemia, you want to think about a sideroblastic anemia being caused by virtue of a B6 deficiency, right? And then also do not forget that people that have isoniazid, again, they can get seizures. They can take have peripheral neuropathy because, again, if you remember going from glutamate to GABA, right, it's a reaction. Like literally GABA is made from glutamate. Remember, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. The enzyme that makes that conversion, glutamate decarboxylase, from glutamate to GABA, uses B6 as a cofactor. So again, if you lack B6, you're going to have a buildup of glutamate. You're going to have a downgrade or a reduction in the amount of GABA you have, right? So more excitation, less relaxation, right? So you're going to get, or less inhibition. So you're going to be more predisposed to getting seizures. And then, again, isoniazid, again, because it depletes your B6. Remember, many of the enzymes that operate in the liver, many of those transaminase enzymes, right, like ALT, AST, all these things, they all depend on vitamin B6. B6 is the cofactor for many of these hepatic enzymes, right? So again, if a person lacks B6 because they are taking isoniazid without listening to their doctor, then those people are going to promptly get in trouble. And again, I feel like in general, acid fast organisms, for some bizarre reason, tend to be high yields to know on exams, right? So what are the high yield acid fast organisms to know for exams? Obviously, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, right? But in that classic one, this one, they'll say, oh, you see acid fast oocysts in a person's stool. If you say, for HIV patient that has diarrhea, I would hope with that you're thinking about Cryptosporidium parvum, right? Cryptosporidium parvum. Remember, Cryptosporidium, you treat it with paromomycin or nitazoxanide, right? Paromomycin or nitazoxanide. And then the other acid fast organism you may see on an MBM exam is if a person has nocardia, right? Remember, nocardia is also acid fast, right? It's also acid fast. That's one of those weird things that that they love to test on exams, right? And don't forget your TB, induration cutoffs, right? For exams, right? So remember, 5 millimeters is a person that has HIV. So 5 millimeters, HIV person, right? 10 millimeters, healthcare workers, right? And then 15 millimeters is positive in everyone, right? So just things, again, you want to keep at the back of your mind on these tests. Okay. And then what if they give you a question about some person that, went on a field trip to New Hampshire, right? And then for the last, 3 weeks, the person has been having, bad joint pain. And they tell you in the question that the person did not notice any tick bites or anything of that sort. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about Lyme disease, right? Remember, again, Lyme disease is caused by Borrelia burgdorferi. And it's actually high yield to know that Borrelia burgdorferi is a spirochete. I don't know, for whatever bizarre reason, bugs that are spirochetes, the MBMEs, love these things. That's one reason you should know. Another reason why you should know bugs that are spirochetes is because these bugs, when you're treating people that have these bug problems, one thing that can happen is they can have this thing known as the Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction. The Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction is not something you only see with syphilis, because syphilis is another spirochete. It's technically a reaction you can see with any spirochete. So the newer MBMEs, it's not too much of a stretch to imagine them giving you a Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction question in a person that has Lyme disease, right? So remember, what are the high yield spirochetes to know for exams? Treponema pallidum, that's syphilis, right? Borrelia burgdorferi, right? And then this bug that, you find in Hawaii a lot, Leptospira interrogans, right? The bug that causes leptospirosis, that's a spirochete, right? So technically, anyone that has any of those problems can get a Jarisch-Hexheimer reaction, right? So this person obviously has Lyme disease. So how do we diagnose Lyme disease? Well, I hope you're telling me that, you're going to do an ELISA first, right? And then you confirm the diagnosis with a Western blot. And remember that Lyme disease, if a person has these joint manifestations or has the bullseye rash, right? You're gonna, if they are less than 8 years old, you're gonna give them amoxicillin, right? You're gonna give them amoxicillin. But if they're more than 8 years old, you give them doxycycline. Remember that amoxicillin rule also applies to pregnant females, right? You're not gonna give doxycycline to a pregnant woman. That would not be ideal, right? That would not be ideal. Because, you know, cause all these teratogenic problems in the kid. But one exception I want to mention to these diagnostic testing rules is, if, for example, a person has like the classic bullseye rash, erythema chronicum migrans, is a classic question, you don't need to do any kind of diagnostic testing. For those people, you can just go ahead and give them doxycycline and call it a day. You don't need to do any diagnostic testing when the person has the classic erythema chronicum migrans presentation in an NBME question. Just something to keep at the back of your mind there, right? And again, remember that Borrelia burgdorferi is carried by the Ixodes tick, right? By the Ixodes tick. And remember that tick also carries Anaplasma and Babesia, right? Also carries Anaplasma and Babesia. Remember by Babesia microti, right? That's the thing that has that Maltese cross pattern on a blood smear, right? You look at the red blood cells, has this Maltese cross pattern. So again, if you see a person that was recently exposed to the New England area, right? Again, Boston, so, you know, all these people from Harvard, so Boston, New Hampshire, New York, right? All those people, Yale, Connecticut, stuff like that, right? If you see these kinds of people, right? And you notice that they have like malaria style symptoms, and they tell you that this person did not travel internationally. You want to be thinking about Babesia under those circumstances. You want to be thinking about Babesia under those circumstances. And then, one other thing I want to mention with Lyme disease is whenever a person has Lyme that has started going to their brain or attacking their heart, so like Lyme myocarditis or like Lyme disease affecting the brain, then those people, you can't give them doxycycline or whatever anymore. You need to kind of step up your game. You need to give those people a third generation cephalosporin, right? Like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime. Again, that's actually very important to know for exams. I don't know, for whatever bizarre reason, cefotaxime is beginning to become more and more important on NBME exams as a third-gen cephalosporin. It's just something that, for whatever reason, many people don't know. So that's like one of these high-value drugs that have started popping up on NBME exams. Kind of like the same thing with even in SBP, right? Spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, it'll be like person that has some kind of ascites for any reason, right? It can be ascites because they have liver disease. It can be ascites because they have some kind of plastic in the abdomen. It can be ascites because a person has Budd-Chiari syndrome or whatever. If you have ascites for any reason, right, and then the person is having like abdominal pain, altered mental status, mild fever, think about SBP under those circumstances, right? You know, from translocation of bacteria. So for those people, you typically want to do a paracentesis, right? And then you're looking for those neutrophils. If you find more than 250 neutrophils, you have your diagnosis, right? You have your diagnosis. And then after that, you give those people a third. You're not trying to find bugs. All you're looking for is neutrophils. That's literally the diagnostic criteria, right? If you find more than 250 neutrophils, you are good to go, right? You are good to go. You go ahead and give those people third-gen cephalosporin, again, like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime. Another of these weird cephalosporins that are kind of getting high yield on exams is cefazolin, right? So we know that every surgeon, if you ask a surgeon, what is the number one, at least in the U.S., what is the number one antibiotic in the world? What are they going to scream right back at you? NSAID. I don't know, surgeons, man, those people love their NSAID. They love their, and I mean, it works pretty well. And I mean, they love it for obvious reasons, because it's something that is used in pretty much most surgeries, right? Remember, NSAID is cefazolin, right? Cefazolin is given about 30 to 60 minutes, right, before like the incision is made. This is actually one of those high yield guidelines to know, right? Why is it important to know? There are these bizarre questions they love to throw at people, right? They will tell you that, oh, person surgery was still scheduled for 10 a.m. Person got IV cefazolin like at 9:20 or 9:30 or whatever, right? And then a big trauma comes in. Person surgery has to be bumped to 4 p.m. And then they will now say, what's the next best step in management? You need to give the cefazolin again, okay? Again, you need to give it within that 30 to 60 minute window before the surgery proceeds. That's actually very high yield. Very high yield to know, right? That's actually very high yield to know. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about like, what if they give you a question about patient. You know, they tell you she's like a 22-year-old female. And they tell you that, you know, for the past 2 weeks, she's been having like really bad sore throat, having a lot of joint pain. And then they can show you a picture, right? And you notice that you see like almost like this big inclusion inside a cell, right? This is one of those classic pictures they want to show you on tests that you want to be able to recognize, right? If you see this, like, it will be like a big intranuclear inclusion. If you see it, I would really hope that you're thinking about CMV, right? You're thinking about CMV, right? So you see this person has like a mononucleosis style syndrome, right? But you see like very skimpy on the details, right? I will say, for example, CMV, like there are some bugs where the pictures are high yield to be able to identify on NBME exams. CMV is one. Anthrax, especially with these military style questions, they've been popping on exams these days. Anthrax, yeah. This is a very classic picture. Kind of looks like a bunch of blue. That's just like blue, like straight rods that are kind of like crisscrossing. I look through that. And then those endemic fungi, right? So like Histoplasma capsulatum, coccidiomycosis with those spherules, right? Those are high yield pictures to keep in mind. And I guess maybe one thing I should go ahead and say is, step one is becoming pass-fail, right? Step two, CK, they're beginning to bring in quite a number of step one concepts on the exam. So I think one thing that you should maybe expect from my podcast going forward is that I'll mostly be talking about step two CK stuff, but there are some step one things that are high value targets that I'll try to highlight so that you're exposed to those before you take your exam, right? So essentially, and my life lesson today will be like some study advice. It'll be some study advice using my podcast just to kind of clarify some misconceptions I feel like people have, right? But basically, this person has CMV. Remember the classic association with the Alzheimer's nucleus, right? And people that have CMV, right, you give them ganciclovir, right? You give them ganciclovir. Now, what is one step one detail they can throw in here, right? The thing is, CMV, if you do the monospot test on a person that has CMV, the monospot test will be negative, right? That's a high yield thing to know. Another high yield thing to know is they may ask you about the mechanism of resistance to ganciclovir on a test. Remember, ganciclovir, for it to work, if you again go back to your step one pharmacology, right? Because it's like a nucleoside analog, right? Essentially, what needs to happen to it is it needs to be phosphorylated. And then when it's phosphorylated, it can then be inserted into DNA, but then that will cause like chain termination. And then you'll be able to produce DNA anymore, right? Because it will essentially inhibit DNA polymerase, right? That's the exact same thing that happens with ganciclovir. Ganciclovir, to work, it needs to be phosphorylated by a kinase. That kinase is known as the UL97 kinase, right? It's known as the UL97 kinase. So if a person has a mutation in the UL97 kinase, they will have CMV resistance to ganciclovir. So how do we treat CMV that's resistant to ganciclovir? Typically, for those people, we give them foscarnet, right? Foscarnet is a pyrophosphate analog, right? That is used to treat ganciclovir-resistant CMV or acyclovir-resistant herpes, right? The good thing about foscarnet is it does not need a kinase for activation, right? It's already in a the drug is already like a phosphorylated drug, right? So it skips that kinase activation step and it can be incorporated directly into DNA. These are, again, all high yield things to know for exams. And remember that CMV, right? Whenever a kid has congenital CMV, that kid will have microcephaly, right? And then they'll tell you about the periventricular calcifications that surrounds the child's brain, right? That's the way you differentiate CMV from toxo, right? Remember, toxo will cause calcifications in the brain, but it will be throughout the cerebral cortex, right? But if you see calcifications around the ventricles, right, you want to think about CMV, right? Or just, I guess, since we're still on the topic of calcifications, as I wrap up this rapid review, if you look at, if they tell you that, oh, you see, let's talk about like some high yield calcifications that kind of pop around the body. Calcifications, like the concept of calcification is a high yield concept you could see on exams, right? So if they tell you a question about a person that has like a brain tumor or brain mass, and you're seeing calcifications in the frontal lobe, right? I would hope you're thinking about an oligodendroglioma. I think I may have said this in a previous podcast, but if I've not, let me just go ahead and talk about it now. Repetition always helps, right? So remember, calcified mass, frontal lobe, oligodendroglioma, right? If they give you a question about a child that has a calcified suprasellar mass, and this child may potentially have like a bitemporal heteronymous hemianopsia, then I would really hope that you're telling me that, oh, this child likely has craniopharyngioma, right? Remember, craniopharyngiomas, they tend to be supracellar. They tend to be calcified. They love to compress the optic chiasm, right? So, and remember that thing where they leak motor oil fluid? I feel like probably one of the biggest concepts to know with regards to craniopharyngiomas on MBMEs is the embryologic association. Remember, those things are derived from Rathke's pouch, although sometimes on MBME exams, you may see them referred to as oral ectoderm, right? And oligodendrogliomas, don't forget that they are one of those things that have this fried egg appearance on histology, right? So if you see like a fried egg appearance on histology, think about oligodendrogliomas. Although you would also want to think about those with those coelocytes that are associated with HPV, right? The coelocytes associated with HPV infection also have that fried egg appearance. Okay, so back to calcification. So we said calcified supracellar mass, that's going to be a craniopharyngioma. If they want to be mean, because again, in this day and age, one tool that the MBME loves to use a lot is to give you alternate terms for the same thing, right? So don't be surprised if you see a term like adamantinomatous, like adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma. That's another name that's used in the world of pathology for that stuff, right? So oligodendrogliomas also have calcifications, frontal lobe, right? I've talked about how if, for example, you see a person that has calcifications in the cerebellum, right? They tell you that, oh, it's a person that has a calcified cerebellar mass. And then this person has like a very high hematocrit. I would encourage you to think about a hemangioblastoma under those circumstances, right? Think about a hemangioblastoma under those circumstances. Remember, hemangioblastomas, they love to be calcified and they're going to be in the cerebellum. They're going to be in the posterior fossa on an MBME exam, right? And then if you see like calcifications around the person's heart, you want to be thinking about constrictive pericarditis on an MBME exam, right? If you see calcifications around the person's pancreas, right? You want to be thinking about chronic pancreatitis on an MBME exam, right? If you see like stippled, punctate calcifications around the person's gallbladder, that's something that's known as porcelain gallbladder, right? Porcelain gallbladder has a very high yield association with a person potentially having gallbladder cancer or cholangiocarcinoma, right? But more classically, gallbladder cancer. For those people, you actually want to go ahead and resect. You want to do like an elective cholecystectomy, right? And then if you see calcified mass in a female, right, and it's in the adnexa, right, or in the pouch of Douglas, right, like the rectouterine pouch, then under those circumstances, you want to think about a teratoma, right? Sometimes on exams, they may call this a dermoid cyst, right? So keep those in mind on MBME exams, right? And then remember, you can also see calcifications in the kidneys, especially in a person that has primary hyperparathyroidism, right? And then remember, people that have diabetes, right? Especially a diabetic that has peripheral arterial disease, right? You may check their, what is this ratio called? Come on, Divine, think. Yes, their ABI, the arterial brachial index. And you'd be like, wow, this person's ABI is like 1.5. Like some crazy high number. You're like, wow, this person's ABI is better than good. No, it is not better than good. Those people actually have a peripheral arterial disease. But the thing is, their blood vessels have been calcified. That's something that classically on MBME exams is referred to as Munkeberg calcific sclerosis. I'll say that again. Munkeberg, I believe it's spelled M-O-N-C-K-E-R-B-E-R-G. Munkeberg calcific sclerosis, right? That's something you find in diabetics, right? So their ABI will be better than good. The way you go further with that is, if the ABI is super high, you've not ruled out PAD. What you need to do for those people is you need to do a TBI. You need to perform something called a toe brachial index, right? You need to perform something known as a toe brachial index. Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here with my calcification spiel, right? And I'm going to stop here actually with a rapid review, right? So what's the life lesson I want to throw in today? The life lesson I want to throw in today is specifically concerning study advice for step 2 CK, right? So what is the ideal way to use my podcasts, right? The thing is, I can see this without shadow of doubt, because again, I'm not saying this based on, I'm just saying it now. I have reams and reams and reams of evidence for this. I mean, I've worked with tons of students. In my lifetime, or even over the past year, I've worked with tons and tons and tons of students. The ideal way to study, if you're like, oh, Divine, if you were to give me one advice in terms of being super comprehensive, like super, super comprehensive with my studying for Step 2 CK, what can I do as a content source? The prudent thing I would say to do is to get through the videos, start off your dedicated period getting through the videos that I have for the different disciplines, right? So I have videos for psych, for OB-GYN, for peds, for surgery, and for internal medicine. Get through those videos. Know those things and know them cold, right? The good thing about those videos is, guess what? They have slides on them, right? And for internal medicine, the slides just contain the questions. I review the answers in the video. But remember, there are also notes on my website that you can use alongside as you're watching those videos that already have the answers to those things mentioned, right? Again, there's this Google Doc floating around. I just basically have a link to it on my website where people transcribe pretty much every Step 2 CK content that I put out there. Although, obviously, the notes you write yourself, you'll probably remember them a lot better than notes that you just passively read. But if you're strapped for time, consider reading through those notes as you're listening to the podcast. Again, the videos will help you with the understanding, right? For neurology, the prudent thing to do is to go ahead and listen to the neuro podcast that I have, right? I have 8 neuro podcasts, but again, they're very, very high yield. They're very, very comprehensive, right? And then after you're done with that, the thing I would then recommend you do is considering going through those special topics, right? There's a column, there's a spreadsheet on my website that lists like a lot of the stuff that I have for Step 2 CK, right? And there's a column that says special topics, risk factors. That special topics column, again, it's a lot of podcasts, right? But you can pick out the areas you feel weak with, right? Like you can say, okay, I feel really bad with electrolytes. Pick up the electrolytes podcast, listen to it. Oh, I feel awful with genetic diseases. Listen to the genetic diseases podcast, right? Or, oh, I feel bad with the risk factors. Listen to episode 37, 97, 184, 239. Those are the risk factors podcasts, right? So those podcasts, I made them with like, almost like a 5-question goal in mind. My goal making those podcasts was, each of these podcasts may get you like between 3 to 5 questions on a test. Like the electrolyte podcast will probably get you a lot more than 5 questions, right? But those are usually like high yield topics. That's where I have like the stuff on the military, the stuff on geriatrics, the stuff on bias, the stuff on risk factors, the stuff on nephritic syndromes, the stuff like on vasculitides, on shock, right? Stuff like that, right? So those are high value things to try to listen to. And then the rapid review series, what I would encourage you to do with the rapid review series is just while you're, because most of them are short, most of them are like 30 minutes or less long, right? Just listen to those while you're working out or eating or whatever, right? Those will expose you to high yield clinical cases that tend to pop up very frequently on the exams, right? I mean, like, and I guess if we're going for the very extreme case of my Step 2 CK content, there are a couple people that have actually spent the time pretty much listening to all the Step 2 CK content I have, all the special topics, all the rapid reviews, gone through all the videos. I have data from some of these people, and many of these people have done extremely well on their exams. Like if you truly, 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 again, it's a big ordeal. It will require a pretty decent amount of work. But if you listen to everything I have in my Step 2 CK folder, you'll almost certainly do extremely well on your exams. Obviously, you're going to supplement that by doing like questions from a QBank. And then, as I recommend, those MBME practice Shelfa exams. So those are the recommendations I'll give. Again, I've had people get 270s, high 260s, very, very high scores, reviewing all that content and then doing a QBank and doing those practice MBME Shelfa exams. So thank you for listening. Again, if you want to register for any of those courses, reach out to me and I'll give you information about the cost and the timing and all that fun stuff. And I will see you in the next podcast. And please take care of yourselves. Remember, health is wealth. Thank you. God bless you.